in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might also be listening on CFBX in Kamloops or Axe Radio Canada in Nova Scotia, or online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. And Happy New Year to you. Last week I came into the station and there was actually a mix-up. I had Julia Asante in my calendar, and the interview was actually supposed to be for today, and then I emailed, and so I'm double booked for today, and we have Julia, the lovely Julia Asante, who is in Vancouver. She's going to be at Banyan Books, I believe, tomorrow. We'll talk about that. And today's booked guest is James Olson, and he is the author of The Whole Brain, Path to Peace, and he is a philosopher, and he has spent years and years researching the the hemispheres of the brain, and we're going to be talking about that, as well as Julia Asante's book, The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. And she is an academic as well as a psychic medium, and so we are just going to roll with this, and I want to apologize and thank both of my guests for being so willing to just see how this unfolds. So it's quite a melding of topics here, and we'll just see how it goes. So welcome to the show, James Olson. You're on the phone right now. Hi.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How you doing?
Namaste.
Namaste. So now tell us, I will introduce, let Julia speak a little bit about herself in a moment, but tell us about the research that you've been doing and a little bit about your book, The Whole Brain, Path to Peace. It's the role of left and right brain dominance in the polarization and reunification of America.
Well, it was discovered by Roger Sperry back in the 70s that the split in our brain actually creates a conflict within us. He won the Nobel Prize for this in 1981 for this discovery and others. And this conflict between the two hemispheres really destroys our peace. You know, we're born with peace. We can find peace in many places, in nature, for example. We can go there, but the conflict really, we can also take our conflict there and within our mind. And so my focus is mind management, how we can manage the two sides so that they are in harmony with one another and eliminate this internal conflict, because all of our conflict in the world starts within us, within various people. And so that's, you know, the book is really about the two hemispheres and how they affect our choices we make, because all of our choices start, you know, we are spirit, we have a mind, and we have a body, and the mind is our creative medium, and it's where we really have the most control over our lives, and this is something that that we have to manage. You know, we either manage consciously or we manage according to how we've been taught to manage our mind and our lives, and so this seemed like the most productive area that I could think of, and so that's why I wrote this book about this issue.
Awesome. Well, thank you, James, for that wonderful explanation. And I am curious about the politics in the conservatives and the liberals and all. Well, that's what we have in Canada as liberals. Anyway, so Julia actually has a question for you, though.
Yeah, actually, it wasn't a question. It was in my own book, I write a great deal against dualisms. I think that's somewhat of a byproduct of what you're talking about. This idea of opposition and light and dark, instead of it being arbitrary points of a whole. For me, it certainly translates more into notions of reward and punishment, heaven and hell, constructs that I'm working very, very hard to get rid of. So I'm completely with you there, James.
Wonderful. Okay. And so, James, yeah, you talk about how Democrats tend to be on their right side of the brain and conservatives are on the left side of the brain, and neither one of them is really, like, they're sort of ingrained in that one side and not looking at it from a holistic view, and that's why there's all this, like, trouble, right?
Yes, that's right. There's actually a dual polarity in the sense that we have the left and the right brain is one set of polarities, because one looks at the part and the other looks at the whole, and the left brain is itself a polar brain, and its perspective is polarized and into the extremes of light and dark and good and bad. So that's the way the left brain sees things. So it's sometimes a little confusing when we talk about the dualistic system, because there's kind of a nested dualism. Which makes it more complex. But once you see that there's kind of two dualistic forces working together, it helps understand what's happening to us a little better.
There's also not just dualisms, but these dualisms are hierarchized. There's always one better than the other, such as light and dark. And this way of thinking is, as you say, it's not holistic, it's exclusive. And it pits one thing against another. This is a way we have learned to conceive of reality, which is a terrible shame.
Yes,
they're also beginning to, they're doing research on the heart as well, as an information system, as a mechanism that works in a similar ways as the brain in terms of being able to perceive information fields. So when I do work with people, I get them to read from the heart. I call it heart speak. I don't mean it in the way of the spiritual love and all of that sort of stuff. I'm meaning it in a way of an actual biological mechanism that has gone unacknowledged since the time of Mesopotamia in Egypt.
Hmm.
And it's becoming more and more recognized now by science.
Interesting. James, what do you think of that concept?
Well, yes, I agree. And I even down to the cellular level, the cells are conscious, and the cells have a brain of their own. My belief is that the heart is connected to the right brain, and the right brain is connected to the left. And so there's a linearity, but there's also a circular, you can also see this in a circular way, in which it all comes back around.
What you have to be looking at, moreover, is modes of perception. Right brain perception, left brain perception, not thinking. The heart electromagnetic field is enormous. It seems in many circumstances to exceed that of the brain. And basically we're talking about how one perceives rather than how one thinks. The thinking is about training, perception and reception have to do with what we've turned off in terms of that training. In your terminology, in the way you're thinking about it, and I agree with you totally, in the right brain versus left brain split.
Well, yes, we need, I focus on the brain, but really feeling is, and the heart is more important, but somebody needs to clear up some issues about the brain. So that's where my focus has been.
Well,
being left brain myself, and thought oriented, I understand the world of thought, so I'm better equipped to talk about thoughts. But I always try to communicate, to let people know that our feelings are more important if you're going to categorize, if you're going to judge them. But actually we need both. We need to be in touch with our feelings, and we need to be in touch with our mind, with the thought processes.
I'm not
well.
Talking just about feelings though, James, at all. I'm talking about real information. It can even be futuristic. If you looked at the near-death experience studies, for instance, and people's brains are dead often. There is no brain activity whatsoever. And yet their perceptual abilities, their memory, vision, even for blind people. All of that becomes extraordinarily enhanced. The brain is not operating, but the mind is. Where do you factor that into your scenario?
Well, the mind is the mind is the higher. We are spirit, and we have a mind, and these are two different kinds of energies. And physical energy, the brain is a physical energy, and it's like the hardware interface to the electricity of the mind, the non-physical mind. And so the mind is always alive. Spirit is minded, and we are spirit, and we never die, and we never lose our mind or our connection with our mind, as far as I know, because I think mind I think spirit is eternal, and mind is everywhere. So when the body dies, the brain dies, but the mind would still be there. And I also want to comment that I can just barely hear Julia, and I missed part of that. I may have missed part of the question. So if you want to.
Terrific.
I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing.
All right. Well, I'll turn up her mic. And James, I just have to give you kudos for, I mean, you were expecting to be interviewed about your book today, and now you're being interviewed by a medium.
Yes. So, well, you're handling it very well. James, I'm an academic too. Don't fear.
So now let's talk a little bit about your book, Julia. So Julia is an academic as well as a medium. We're speaking with Julia Asante, and she is the author of The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. And you're going to be, tell us a little bit about your appearance at Banyan Books tomorrow on West 4th Avenue in Vancouver.
Yeah, it's a talk and a book signing at 7 o'clock at Banyan Bookstore. And I hope people show up. Please come. Love to meet you.
Wonderful. So tell us now about your book, and I can see you're very excited about this, the topic of the dualistic issue with the brain. So tell us a little bit about your opinion on it.
Well, you know, for me, working as a professional intuitive and medium all these years certainly gives you a very different view on information gathering and modes of thinking. But in tandem with that, I'm a scholar of the ancient world, very ancient. The Bible for me is new, ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, and most of my material goes back to 2.5, almost 3,000 years, through cuneiform generally, so that I've been looking at different modalities of thought, of constructs, of afterlife perceptions for a very long time. And this exclusivism, we're talking about these dualisms that we're talking about, actually don't start to show up until 14th century BC in Middle Kingdom Egypt, when you started to get a morality system for the afterlife. Mm. And because they, you know, weighing the soul against a feather, see if the morality of the soul is at the right weight for you to continue. Before then, everyone was eternal, had the potential for eternity. Everyone went to an afterlife, which is much more similar to traditional religions, traditional traditions of afterlife thinking and concepts. In the 7th century BC, you get an elimination, practically, of the afterlife. It's very complicated in biblical scripture. It's contradictory. The old system of Sheol more or less disappears. Sheol was an afterlife vision that was inclusive rather than exclusive. So I think, just to team up with James a little bit more, I think you're looking at a shift right there and then with the invention of sin and judgment and opposition. The sin was invented in the 5th century BC. You're starting to get this polarization in the way we understand reality and human nature. So part of my message is, yes, just as James said, yes, we all survive no matter what. No part of the personality dies. And even in terms of incarnation, it all happens at once. It's simultaneous. There's no time. This is a non-space, non-time dimension. what we call non-locality or non-local reality. And all things exist at once, as do we in adjacent realities with our own incarnations, or some of them could even be in physical body, where in the same time and place we are in now. So this whole cause and effect thing, which is also part of a left brain system, this whole cause and effect thing is actually bogus. And even in terms of incarnation, there is no evidence in all the research that's been done for karma or karmic debt.
Interesting.
So for me, my main message is to, first of all, eliminate the fear of death, which brings a person to their authenticity, to their natural morality. People who have lost the fear of death have no need for competition. They turn to service rather than, remain greedy, which is a problem. Greed and heaping up, as the Bible says, is in some ways an effort for immortality. Become powerful and invulnerable.
Well, that whole concept of wanting to leave behind a legacy.
Yes.
Yeah. So why? So people will be talking about you when you're gone?
And overpopulation is also an aspect of that. So I look at the fear of death from the point of view of the way religions have inculcated fear in order to maintain their own institutions, because it only happens with centralized institutions that work with death cults, such as the mortuary cults of Egypt, but also the way it happens in the secular world, in that we are completely and entirely open, vulnerable to the exploitation of this fear. In every area you can think of, even the way we teach history is about this. We teach history according to wars, dynastic takeovers, famines, what have you. Certainly the medical industry, which teaches that your body is a time bomb, that death is a pathology, or an enemy that should be fought. Pharmaceuticals, insurance are quite obvious. The anti-aging industries, the health and beauty industries are outrageous. The sort of money that they're taking in, playing on this fear, and news and entertainment, equally outrageous, in that, in news or entertainment, it's a steady feed all the time of the most gruesome possible deaths. And if anyone had the sort of fantasies that you see on TV at night in an entertainment show around death, chopping up a body or grinding it up or whatever, you would be considered psychopathic. Mm-hmm. At the same time, in real life, everyday situations, we don't talk about death is considered morbid. And you think of the words we have: coffin, casket, corpse, even the dead. All of these words are macabre in some way. They're sinister. And this is, again, going back to James, another kind of dualism, life versus death type of thing, in which case life is always superior to death.
I'm going to pause you there because it's time for us to take a break. So this is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie Bernard. We have James Olson waiting so patiently on the phone right now. He is the author of The Whole Brain, Path to Peace, The Role of Left and Right Brain Dominance in the Polarization and Reunification of America. And we're also joined by Julia Asante in studio. She's author of The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. She is a medium and an academic. She's going to be at Banyan Books tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. That is Tuesday evening. What is it? The 14th, 15th of January now. And she will be there at 7 o'clock signing books and
giving a talk
and speaking with people. So that's on West 4th Avenue in Vancouver. So we'll be back with more Synchronicity in a moment.
In the year 1963, French artist Robert Filou chose January 17th as art's birthday and pronounced art 1 million years old.
On January 17th, CITR celebrates with 24 hours of radio art. That's 24 hours of the weird and the reckless in your ear holes. Tune in to hear radio and sound art, noise and experimental music, and all the strangeness CITR programmers and the Vancouver community has to offer. Guest hosts and artists include Prophecy Sun, Patrick Sampler, Whip the UFO, sound artists Anna Fritz, Julie Gendron, and Emma Hendricks, Giorgio Magnanesi of Vancouver New Music, and more. For schedule updates on all our birthday madness, stay tuned to CITR and like us on Facebook. To participate, submit your art or weirdo idea by midnight Sunday, January 13th to arts@catr.ca. Happy 1,050,000th birthday, Art!
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Hello and welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie Bernard, and we're joined by James Olson, a philosopher and author about his book is called The Whole Brain Path to Peace. And we're also joined by Julia Asante, a medium and academic, and she's author of The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. So, as you may be, if you're just tuning in, this is just, we were supposed to be talking with James Olson today. There was a happy accident that there was some communication problems from last week's interview. And so Julia is actually in studio right now. So this is really interesting to have people, two people coming from really different viewpoints. And yet it sounds like you both have some agreements with this whole dualism issue. James, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I'm just delighted that this happened, and I think there are no accidents. Julia is just delightful, and I think I agree with everything that I hear, and I'm learning new things, and I've never been afraid of death. I don't know what that feels like, and it's interesting to hear about all these things that are occurring in this life that are a response to this fear of death, and it actually explains a lot of the crazy things that are happening in this world. And I'm just delighted that to be here today and to join the two of you.
It's a definite left brain fear, James. It's completely that. It comes completely from the ego side, the side that only believes in what we can perceive through the physical senses, what we think are the physical senses. And, James, if I took all of the energy out of your atoms, all the space out of your atoms, you'd be collapsed down to a very small microscopic dot. So there's really nothing much physical there. So the ego is really trying to hold on to something that's largely projection. It's all done by light shows. So,
I point that out in my book.
I'm about, sure.
It's so interesting to hear this from you, from your perspective, being so different.
Well, I look a lot at the brain. In fact, I'm right now looking very strongly at the effect of technology on our ability to understand or pick up subtler and subtler electrical impulses.
And I believe you addressed that in your book as well, don't you, James?
Yes. It's all there. There's everything is energy and movement and vibration, and I've been focusing. Went to a sound healing workshop over the December 21st and 22nd at the solstice, and it really, I think it changed me. I feel different. I don't know if I feel different because of the shift into the new era and the hope that it is bringing me, or whether, whether it's that and the vibration, but the energy of sound healing really changes the vibration of our body and can help bring us into greater harmony And I feel different since the solstice.
Mm. I think that the notion of harmony and the notion of love and all of that sort of thing is not something we even have to aim for. It's just something that happens as we uncover ourselves or excavate ourselves from all the fears that we live with. I think those things actually emerge. The authentic self emerges, and within that is the knowledge of wholeness. Brings out our altruism, which is a natural component. I'm very anti-Darwin, by the way, totally anti-Darwin. I see Darwinian theory as coming out of these major conflict theories of his era, the imperialistic era, which played entirely on dualisms of the superior over the inferior. You see it in Marxism and Freud. That's the age, the intellectual age he was born in and his work was born in. So I'm in my own work, I try, at my own academic work, I try very hard to turn over the elements of Darwin and even spiritual evolution in this last frontier, but in my academic stuff, evolution of civilization, where the newer, culminating, of course, in the Victorian gentleman, but the newer civilizations always being superior to the inferior, later, older ones, which is the way Darwin thought. And his cousin was, he invented eugenics, which is absolutely incredibly frightening. And this was the climate of the time. And we're still very much stuck with that, and our spiritual traditions are stuck with that. It's entrenched in everything, and in my own field of ancient history, archaeology, very much so, and even in medicine. We cannot escape this hierarchical stuff, which has to do, again, with pitting one portion of the self against the other portion of the self.
And it's interesting, actually, this weekend I was listening to Alison Armstrong, a CD by Alison Armstrong. She's a relationship expert. And what she actually talks about is the human-animal behavior, our instinctive behaviors, and she distinguishes that from human spirit, which is the more evolved conscious behavior. And so she tries to teach people, like, these are the things that are instinctive that you're not going to be able to control until you become aware of them, right? And so it's like balancing our animalistic selves with our more evolved, I guess, maybe right brain.
I'm sorry to say, Marie, I couldn't disagree more.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I think animals are much more evolved than we are. We're the ones who are destroying everything, not they. And this is exactly what I mean about Darwinian thinking that's just embedded in everything, in psychology and everything. I don't even like the notion of evolution. I hate the notion of spiritual evolution. We're all transcendent. It's some portion of us is already transcendent. And the rest of it is about judgment. Mm-hmm. It's about really about creativity. And we have models in anthropology, primate studies, for instance, like the bonobo, in which there is absolutely no physical harm from one animal to another. It's all actually a matriarchal system. And it's the sort of thing that anthropologists don't like to look at because we have painted a very ugly version of what humanity is, which is aggressive and hierarchical and will always war. This is all exactly what I'm talking about. This is how we keep fostering false ideas, mm-hmm. and it comes from Darwin, most of it.
Well, I don't think, I mean, as far as the relationship stuff, I mean, I don't think that it's judging to say, like, these are the instincts and these are the things that we do, because right in the society that we're in, we deny our instinctive selves and judge ourselves and punish ourselves. And until we become aware of this is how we are as human animals and why we behave in the way that we do, so that you can actually, like, bring it together and do, like, live in a society. I don't know. James, what do you think?
Animals don't judge.
But we do.
Yeah, that's the problem.
James, sorry?
Judgment is a word that we don't all agree on how it's defined. There are two aspects to judgment or not. One is discernment. And the other, what I really think of as judgment, the way I use the word, is whether something is good or bad. Mm-hmm. That's what I call judgment, and the left, that's what the left brain does. It tries to pick things apart and to see the flaws or to see the good, the difference between good and bad, and so it judges, so that that's its job, and we're in a very left brain society. Most men are left brain dominant, and men have created a left brain culture that that's based on hierarchy. And we teach women to think this way, and so I mean, I agree with Julie said a lot, and so I don't know if I actually
I talk
agree
fast.
With everything or not. But I often find that sometimes when we disagree, it's just because we're kind of looking at something from different perspectives,
mm-hmm.
and that I believe we all have truth and we all have a valid perspective, and it just kind of depends on what you're looking at.
It's interesting, James, and you mentioned that, because I've had arguments with people and about certain topics we'll be debating, and at the root of it, we're actually in agreement, but the way we're looking at it, it seems like we're not, but we just are maybe expressing ourselves in different ways. But I think at the core, I'm not saying every time, but a lot of times I notice that there's actually not a disagreement, it's just how we're expressing our viewpoints.
I think James and I are completely on the same track. Don't you, James?
Yes, as far as I can tell.
We could probably have a lot of long discussions. there's things that you're doing that I actually need to have something written about it in about 2 weeks. So I wouldn't mind having a nice long coffee with you if you've got the time.
Yes.
Where are you, James?
I'm about 45 minutes north of San Francisco.
Perfect. That's where I'll be in 2 days.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, wow. Where are you exactly?
Between San Rafael and Novato.
Perfect. I'm in San Rafael.
All right, we'll stay on the line after the show, James, and,
okay.
and we'll get your phone number or your email so you guys can meet up.
That's
awesome. So now I want to talk a little bit more about specifically your books, because I'm looking at your book right now, and there's all these stickers of prizes on it and awards. And I know Julia had a wonderful review and compliment about her book, so I'm going to let her share that in a moment. But I see you've won the Nautilus Book Award. You've got the Eric Hoffer Award winner for Excellence in Independent Publishing, a Book of the Year for Forward Reviews.
That's the Librarian's magazine.
Wonderful. So, yeah, you've been getting a lot of praise about this book. Wonderful. And so, Julia,
my book just came out.
Mm-hmm.
But I did get a starred review from Publishers Weekly that named it the most important work on the enigma of death since the groundbreaking work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And that to me, of course, means a great deal, because this is not a spiritual community. Publishers Weekly is anything but. So it's a very sort of concrete, rational approach to what I've done. And I value that very, very highly.
Wonderful.
What they said.
And you're going to be at Banyan Books tomorrow in Vancouver at 7 p.m. on West 4th Avenue. And so you're going to San Francisco. There are listeners from all over the world. So.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be in Northern California for 2 weeks. I'm going to be speaking at a bookstore in San Rafael on Friday. And then the following week at the Foundation for Mind Body Research in Palo Alto. Then I go on to Minneapolis for 2 incredibly intense weeks with workshops and lots of talks. Anyone can see all this on my website. It's www.juliaasante.com. And you don't want to hear the rest of the itinerary. It goes on until Austria, and it never stops.
How exciting. So I'm curious now about, I wanted to ask you about the afterlife and about speaking with people on, we'll call it the other side. I don't know if you want to refer to it in that way, because you say that it's all happening at once. And
yeah, it really isn't the other side, and it really isn't even an afterlife. It's a non-physical, the reality that we're all in, and we're not focused on physical reality. Again, as a social historian trained to look at exotic cultures, it's pretty clear that the experiences that we have in the afterlife are highly determined by the cultures we die in, we live and die in. The afterlife is, after all, a state of consciousness. And human consciousness brings what it wants into the afterlife and can reconstruct things. The difference is the awareness that this is constructed by thought. Animals do the same. Your dog will no doubt reconstruct its dog bowl or its bed or whatever it is. And often joins relatives even if they have never met them. And dogs, animals, most animals have it's the same kind of consciousness we have, same mechanisms. When ours is liberated from the left brain, that is, or integrated. And the amount of after-death communication, which everyone is capable of, everyone has telepathy, for spontaneous after-death communication, is 72% of the American population, but that's discounting children, it discounts dreams, it discounts deathbed visions, which are really, really commonly perceived and interact with the deceased. And these new therapies that are working with bringing the deceased in, and that these therapies that can cure things like post-traumatic stress disorder from a war, in Korean War, decades of people suffering from intrusive memories and violent dreams and suicide longings can be healed inside of a few seconds with this kind of contact. In my own time as a professional, I have seen an enormous shift in interest now of people becoming more interested in something that we should have been interested in forever, considering that we're all going to go through this as caregivers, as well as dying ourselves. And but what is amazing to me is how there is not one person yet I've worked with, either in a workshop or privately, even at talks sometimes, when that person has not been able to make contact with someone they love who has departed. And that, to me, is just amazing. And this is where I'm extremely interested, James, this is where I need your help, in understanding more how technology is changing our brains, changing our ability to pick up subtler and subtler electrical impulses. Is all of this, what we're looking at, what we perceive as solid, as distance, as time, that's all about electrical impulses. That's all about our own manufacture and perception.
So I'm curious, both of you, James and Julia, what you think specifically about technology is creating this problem. Is it just that we're so overwhelmed and distracted, or is it the electrical aspect of how we're so plugged in? What do you think? James?
Well, what was the... What was the result? I mean, I guess I didn't understand the question. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so Julia is talking about how the electronic age that we're in is transforming. Like we're less sensitive to. No, I'm not understanding you. Okay,
repeat yourself. Not that we're less sensitive. Our sensitivity is incredibly heightened from this constant interaction with electrical impulses, electrical fields. I think this has a great deal to do with the so-called revolution in consciousness, which I write about in my book about that and how consciousness and technology is changing our consciousness. It's as though, and this is again right for you, James. This is absolutely so right for you. We have so much suppressed. Or repress. It's as though it's bursting out in areas that are bringing us back to a greater integration and a greater knowing.
So, and my question was: do you think it's the focus, the fact that we're so overwhelmed and bombarded with images and just constantly like texting and tweeting and TV and music and all of that, or is it something else?
There's no doubt that stress. Is a great promoter of greater psychic activity, greater modes of perception, even capabilities such as being able to lift a Volkswagen. Stress it generates this. Stressful childhoods generate much more people with much more perceptible psychic abilities. For instance, it's even encoded in religions where you have traditions in which body mutilation is part of achieving a sacred vision. The 40 days and 40 nights in the desert and fasting also to receive a sacred vision. And no place is it more stunning than in a near-death experience when someone is under the knife, for instance, a heart surgery or whatever. That's a lot of stress. And certainly you could consider near-death experiences as sacred visions. So the relationship is quite clear. And it may very well be that the amount of stress that we hold individually in such a fast-paced culture is part of the reason why we are moving forward and in terms of our understanding of consciousness.
I think that the technology is very stressful. It's supposed to help us, but I know I have a lot of issues with stress when I'm working on computers and I'm trying to do a video, and it's just so difficult. And there's just many aspects of life like that, and there may be other people. A lot of other people have even more of this stress coming in, and the world is stressful, but I think this is supposed to be. Everything is happening probably the way it's supposed to happen, and it is accelerating our enlightenment. It is me, because it's been so overwhelming to me that I'm having to retreat and meditate more, and I've been doing a lot of mantras, and I do the mantras as a way of filling my mind with positive thoughts and ideas and keeping them. And I'm a news junkie, but I try to keep away from it because it's so bad and so negative and so polarizing. So I'm in this conflict trying to get away from news and get into good vibrations in my own head as a matter of trying to stay sane in this insane world. And so, yeah, I think the technology is maybe driving us crazy, but maybe it's driving us to enlightenment in ultimately.
Can I tell you a little story, James?
Sure.
There's a woman, she was the daughter of two professional psychics, and so she started her training started at the age of 13. See, for her, this is an everyday, totally integrated aspect of her life. I've gone to her off and on over the years, and she's never been wrong. And there was a certain point where she said that she saw me going through a very intense period of chat rooms, being in chat rooms. And I thought, not on your life. I've never done a chat room. Even this incredibly trained psychic could not see the difference between chat rooms and me having after-death communication, which that is what happened. It was 6 months of constant after-death communication, which got translated as a chat room. This is how close the analogy is. The collapsed cyberspace, as you know, collapsed no dimensions, no space, instant crosses distance, connects strangers, all of this sort of thing, all part of giving us the conceptual frames and the practice to interact in a greater way with greater levels of reality. The simple telephone was the first real movement. Talking to discarnates. That's an amazing thing. And when Bell introduced it to the public, he used Hamlet's soliloquy. So he's talking to a skull. And people were so alarmed, thinking that he had conjured a ghost or a dead person. So technology really has been the back door for us to, which we're entering and creating a much wider field of information and sharing.
It's interesting. So it almost sounds like the internet and then the telephone and all of that is more, I can't really say tangible because you can't touch it, but it's another aspect of non-locality.
It's a training ground. It wow. really is. And it's an analog. It's something that, and I think there's even deeper aspects of this that have to do with this very close interaction with a cell phone, which are all about digital electrical impulses, so that we're able to perceive or catch electrical impulses that are coming to us, which come via telepathy, so-called telepathy. The dead send them to. I feel the presence of the dead often as an electrical phenomenon. The dead sometimes see me only as electrical. They have shown me how they see me. Mm-hmm. And so this somehow, and this is why I need to talk to James, somehow is part of the shift, this subtly ever more sensitive to this level of reality, the electrical level.
All right, well, James, I'm going to let you comment in a moment, but it's time for another break. So this is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and right now we are speaking in studio with Julia Asante. She is the author of The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. And she is going to be at Banyan Books tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. doing a book signing as well as a talk. So if you want to see her, head over to Banyan Books tomorrow evening. And on the phone near San Francisco right now, we've we've got James Olson. He's author of The Whole Brain Path to Peace, The Role of Left and Right Brain Dominance in the Polarization and Reunification of America. And I'm going to send you home with this book, Julia, so you can read it on the plane. And then you can be prepared for, they're going to get together for coffee in San Francisco. So we'll be back with more Synchronicity momentarily.
With the vast amount of changes happening in the world, it's almost impossible to get a clear picture of what's really going on.
We are trapped within the logic of capitalism, leaving us unable to imagine what comes next.
The Extra Environmentalist brings the perspectives of people who can see the whole picture and are ready for whatever comes our way.
Tune in to The Extra Environmentalist every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Hi, my name's Matthew. When I first got back from a military tour in Afghanistan, any time I heard a siren or even a car alarm, I'd lose it completely. I would turn into a wild man, screaming, waving my arms. People would yell at me, "Shut up, you crazy. Get a job, would ya?" Well, I didn't go out and get a job. I got help instead. Now, I'm in a clean and safe apartment. I have friends and helpers who understand me. I landed a decent job. But I gotta admit, I still don't like car alarms or sirens. I used to think mental illness was a death sentence. I got life instead.
This message was produced by Columbian Center Society and Radio Malaspina in British Columbia.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie Bernard, and we're speaking with Julia Asante and James Olson right now about, interesting, the brain and the afterlife, and it all seems to be coming together. So, James, any thoughts?
It's synchronistic. It's your show.
Bound to meet. You and I.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, your microphone's not on. She said you guys were bound to meet.
Yes, yes. Well, it's been, you know, we've had this break, and I guess my mind had wandered, and I don't really know, you know, what to say. I don't disagree. You know, we the basis of our conversation is often disagreement, and I don't have anything to disagree with. I mean, it's all very interesting, and how Julia's work and as how I agree so fully with what she's saying, and although much of it's new, so I don't really know how to. It's kind of difficult to comment.
Well, now we only have a few minutes left in the show because coming up in a moment is Parts Unknown with Chris Arific. And so, actually, I forgot to play his show promo. But anyway, so let's see. Now, I'm curious about the mediumship side of it. You had mentioned that the personality doesn't die. And so what is it like? You said that it really depends on our upbringing and our culture as to how we experience the afterlife. So,
well, it depends on what you need, individual needs and desires. For instance, some people can reconstruct childhood vacation homes, but at the same time, this is sort of multitasking. They're in touch with their incarnations, intermixing with them, not just in touch with them, same with the transcendent self. So there are many aspects of the personality in operation at once, as we are now, although we're bound into a much more limited physical form. When one is out of that physical form, the perceptions become impossibly enhanced. 360-degree vision when you're bothering to use vision. For instance, when you're bothering to use the old modalities of perception that we know. So anything goes. This is what I write about, I'm very aware, is modern Western afterlife experiences. I am every single one, whether it's an animal or a human, is different from the next. But generally there is this feeling of peace, security, extraordinary mobility, euphoria, and this intense sense of a luminosity, of a luminous atmospheric presence. I call it the presence that supports us, that knows us deeply and is full of compassion. Forgiveness is also the number one theme. Given that, there are a lot of people who have difficulty in transition, so that after they die, because of our avoidance of talking about dying or talking about death, and because of the fears that we have about it. They can afterwards either deny that they're dead. This is frequently with people who've taken drug overdoses, or they put themselves in a hell of their own making out of a sense of guilt. And so there are a lot of difficulties because we don't know enough about it. We haven't liberated ourselves from these old paradigms of reward and punishment. At the same time, were we to lessen our fear of death or eradicate it altogether, the way we live and the way we die would alter enormously. If we knew that contact and communication would continue after death, that relationships not only continue, but they improve astoundingly, our planet would change. If you, for instance, Marie, your parents have died.
They have.
Yeah. Very good. And then you begin to contact them. And you find out who they really are without the fear. And that's what they want you to know, too. They really want you to know who they really are without all the fear and this petty human drama that we're all stuck in. You start to change because they show you who they really are. You are face to face with their immortality, and it gives you it gives you a real insight about your own immortality. And the relationship grows because they do not try to hide anymore. They don't give excuses anymore. Their accountability is fully there. The remorse is there, or the encouragement is fully there, or the love is fully embraced. And they want to share that with you. Hmm. And that will make you change. So I call this living relationships, and it's certainly been a great eye-opener for me to have been now 25 years with my parents in ways that I never knew before. I mean, they're still totally recognizable as my parents, but I'm looking at the real ones. Hmm. And then from those experiences, you know who you really are. You start to get a glimpse of who you really are through them. And it's quite an astounding process.
Wonderful. Well, and I have a question actually about karma. You had mentioned that you don't agree with the idea of karma, but so then why do so many people believe in karma? And then if karma isn't real, I mean, you said that
there's no evidence for it.
Okay.
It's not even about my beliefs. First of all, this is not a time reality, so cause and effect could not possibly operate. And karma is based on laws of cause and effect. But researchers have never come up with any indication of it either. So what we are hoping about karma is to have a continuance of reward and punishment systems. And unfortunately, for those who like the idea of revenge, forgiveness actually is the whole of the law, self-revelation, self-realization. That's what brings you to real morality. Real morality comes through real forgiveness, morality that comes from fear. Is not morality at all.
That's and I totally agree with that, because I noticed that people who are they're so concerned about what's going to happen in the afterlife that they're like making decisions to try and like they'll fight holy wars or whatever to try and get into whatever they think is the afterlife, the good part of the afterlife, and yet they're behaving horrifically to people now when really. I mean, for me, like, you're probably going to disagree with this, but I feel like all we have is now.
Yeah. Now in the spacious moment. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I'm amazed you actually agree with me about something. Hey!
I've been really hard on you, Marie. I am a tough person. I'm sorry.
James, do you have any final closing thoughts? We have just three or four minutes left in the show.
Well, I just want to remind people that we are in charge of our lives, and we are do that through our mind. We are what we think we are. We are what we choose to believe. You know, we can believe that we will receive a reward if we engage in holy war, or we can believe in peace and the path of love, and who we are depends on the choices we make, and we do all of that through the mind, and so we're really mind managers, and I'd like to remind everybody that we have these the situation is as if we have these two advisors. One is the right brain perspective, and one is the left brain perspective. And the brain sends these signals to our mind, and as spirit, we look at these choices, what the left brain gives us and the right brain gives us, and we have to come up with an idea. We have to develop how we're going to proceed based on what these two sources are telling us, and that's how we just become who we are. We can go with the left brain's views and become very conservative. We can go with the right brain's views and ignore the left brain views and be more liberal, or we can, as most of us do, integrate the two ideas and the two brain signals in some way. And but we really, I just want to let people know we can't control which brain we use except through mind, because when we ask holistic questions, the right brain's going to answer. If we're looking for details and we're focused and we're in fear, the left brain's going to guide us, or it's going to be the dominant voice in our head. So it's really our choice, and the way to deal with that is to understand what the two choices are, understand what the right brain does and what the left brain does. And you can find out a lot about that at my website, The Whole Brain Path. And if you go to the book page, you can look inside the book and you can read one of the chapters, and it's probably the best chapter, most enlightening chapter in the book, is free. And you can also look at a chart of the left and the right brain, what their perspective is and their processes are. And that's a really good start to understanding yourself, because just as we all have right hands and left hands, and but they may look a little different, they do the same thing, and that's kind of true of our brains. Our left brains are very similar and our right brains are very similar, and the reason we're different is because we integrate them we have so many possibilities of how we can integrate it, and that's what makes us so unique.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, James Olson, author of The Whole Brain Path to Peace. I'm going to ask you to stay on the line so Julia can get your information so you guys can meet up for coffee when she's down in California. Thank you so much for being on the show and for being open to rolling with this unexpected conversation.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Take care. So we're also with Julia Asante. She's the author of The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. And do you have a website, Julia?
Yes, www.juliaasante.com. Not very imaginative, but there you have it.
Wonderful. And she's going to be at Banyan Books here in Vancouver on West 4th Avenue tomorrow at 7 p.m. And now is time for Parts Unknown. So this has been Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. Happy New Year, because this is really the first show I've had of the year, and I will see you or talk to you next week. Be well. I love you so much. Namaste.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
Who is this guy? Does he have a name? Does anybody know where he's from?
From Parts Unknown.
My name's Chris Horrific.
I always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is, without question, the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it, Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Parts Unknown!
Break your fingers!
Now what I want to know, what are you really thinking about?
On January 15th, from 6 to 10 p.m., the AMS Art Gallery presents In a Celluloid Garden, a night of performances by six UBC students collectively commenting on the medium of film. The evening will also include a screening of Stanley Kubrick's last film, Eyes Wide Shut. The event takes place at the UBC Art Gallery in the Sub, entrance by donation.
Baby.
In the year 1963, French artist Robert Filou chose January 17th as Art's birthday and pronounced Art 1 million years old.
On January 17th, CATR celebrates with 24 hours of radio art. That's 24 hours of the weird and the reckless in your earholes. Tune in to hear radio and sound art, noise and experimental music, and all the strangeness CATR programmers and the Vancouver community has to offer. Guest hosts and artists include Prophecy Sun, Patrick Sampler, Whip the UFO, sound artists Anna Fritz, Julie Gendron, and Emma Hendricks, Giorgio Magnanes,